Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and give me a second. Let me just put on this GIMP mask, and I'll be ready to go. Joining me today is Devendra Hardwar.
You mean, like, as usual, Dave? finally, somebody made a Tenchu movie. Amazing.
And Jeff Canella.
Guys, I don't have a sense of how much strength it takes to squeeze a skull to the point where it squishes. Like, do you have to be really strong or like just moderately strong? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. If you were to attempt it, like, has anybody tested just the minimum amount of strength it would take to squeeze a head till it squishes?
I would love to know.
You know, you joke, Jeff. Have you seen those hydraulic press videos on social media?
Oh, of course. Ooh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of those.
And the interpretive dance.
The interpretive dance of it. Yeah. Yeah. So for those who don't know, these videos on like TikTok and Instagram and YouTube where literally the entire video is placing objects underneath a hydraulic press and then squishing them. And there's something very addictive about these videos because...
So satisfying.
Because you genuinely just kind of want to know what happens when you place a Stretch Armstrong doll into hydraulic press. What happens when you place Jell-O into, you know, like... There's something very addictive about this. Anyway, somebody did one with like a human tooth.
Oh, fun.
And it's like, ooh, there's like, it can take a ton of pressure, basically. And so I imagine a skull would be massive.
Well, the teeth aren't being disintegrated. It's the structure of the skull. And I'm sure the robots and the AI are really wondering, what does it take to crush a human?
You know? This is what I'm asking. Like, I don't know. I feel like we haven't experimented in this because it's kind of hard to pull off that experiment. And I feel like in the context of this movie, you know, no spoilers, but it's meant to indicate how strong someone is.
I mean,
feel like, you know,
this is not an unusual thing, Jeff. Skull squeezing, skull crushing. Come on.
I feel like skull crushing might not be as hard as it made out to be. I don't know. I feel like a skull is pretty squishy.
You don't know until you try.
Exactly.
Well, those are all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing the new Timo Jahanto movie, The Shadow Strays, which is available right now on Netflix, apparently in the top 10 list of multiple countries as we're recording this.
Nice.
So really excited to dive into that one. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Find us across many platforms at The Filmcast Pod. We're on YouTube. We're on Instagram. We're posting videos there every week. We're also on TikTok at The Filmcast. And if you want to support the show, patreon.com/filmpodcast. Want to say real quick that in a few episodes, we're going to be having our 800th episode of The Filmcast.
Woo!
We're not going to be doing anything too special. There's not going to be like some live event or anything like that. But yeah, exactly. That's exactly right, Jeff. But what we will do is play a few of your voicemails throughout that episode of your memories and favorite memories and favorite moments from the podcast. You can email those in via /filmcast@gmail.com. Attach a voicemail to those emails and we'll pick our favorites and play them during the course of the episode.
We're not going to do any work, but if you will,
absolutely,
we will gladly play it.
100%. 100%. So /filmcast@gmail.com. Some people have already started sending in the voicemails.
Nice.
Thanks to those who have already done that. Send them in at /filmcast@gmail.com and we will be getting to them on our 800th episode. Speaking of stuff people have sent in, you know, one of the things we've discussed lately on this podcast is the Francis Ford Coppola movie Megalopolis. And there was, of course, a viral clip that went online from that movie in which Adam Driver says to Natalie Emmanuel something I think like, you think 1 year of medical school allows you to plow through the riches of my Embersonian mind? And I have commented on the podcast and on the After Dark about how I want to incorporate that phrase into my daily conversation. Uh-huh, but I'm having a lot of trouble. Somebody at patreon.com/filmpodcast wrote in and commented on that episode and had some really meaningful advice for me about this topic. So I'm going to read it. This comes in from S at patreon.com/filmpodcast. I have put some thought into Dave's Emersonian mind issue, and I thought I would share my conclusions here. Please feel free to ignore them. Number one, it is a line that can only be used if somebody is asked to give their personal perspective on an issue, which is not always something that happens with much regularity, and it can also only be used when the situation is relaxed enough that responding with a joke is acceptable, which limits your opportunities even more. Only someone whose personal opinion is in constant demand would have regular opportunities to use that quote. And number two, an easier alternative to fit it into everyday speech would potentially be to turn it into a question. Instead of using the line to respond to a request for one's personal thoughts, the line could instead be used as a way to ask another human being about their thoughts as follows. Honey, could I plow through the riches of your Emersonian mind for a minute? I'm trying to work out
the
which
new
pasta.
Pick your brain.
Yeah. I'm trying to work out which pasta I should buy for dinner. Jeff, Devingra, if I could plow through the riches of your Emersonian minds, what did the two of you think about the subject of today's review, Morbius Awakening?
I like how he's invented a Morbius sequel.
It comes at the cost of the "you think blank entitles you" element, but it creates significantly more opportunities to at least make a partial reference to the line in everyday life. Maybe that's not enough, but my personal thoughts were that this would be at least a partial solution to how awkward the full line is to insert into everyday conversation.
I love this. I just have one question.
Yes.
Do you think sending an email to our show gives you the right to plow through the riches of our Emersonian mind?
Do you think being a patron entitles you to plow through the ridges of our Emersonian mind? Well, thank you very much for that.
We should also do this for other thinkers and other philosophers. Wittgensteinian minds. Like, let's get into our Wittgensteinian minds.
My Aristotelian mind.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Ooh, my Socratic method.
My Randian
How
philosophy?
Dare you question my Socratic method? Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, thank you so much to S for taking my dilemma seriously.
Do you think this will help you, Dave?
I don't think so, because I do think it needs to have the "you think" a statement of outrage.
The incredulity is
the incredulity
key.
Is part of it, right? Yeah. It's not just I'm not just trying to what do you think I am? I'm not just some cheap hack trying to squeeze in the phrase Emersonian mind into everything. Like,
right.
It needs to have the full blown "you think blank" entitles you to plow through the riches of my Emersonian mind.
It's also something that falls apart outside of like the film nerd bubble. You know, like you go to the normal life and people are like, "Who is this asshole?" Emersonian mind.
I don't care about that.
I think you've achieved his goal.
That's completely fine. That's completely fine with me. So, all right. Well, thanks for the Patreon message, and you can always support us at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We react to your questions and comments and review movies that we can't get to here on the podcast all the time. Okay. Anyway, folks, let's get into today's podcast by starting discussing what we've been watching this week. This week, I had a chance to watch Smile 2.
Still smiling.
Still smiling.
Still smiling.
Now, Devendra, you had a chance to watch Smile 1 this week. You only recently watched Smile 1. Is that correct?
I have. So I have questions, actually, because I hear this is a big upgrade. I got to quickly say, there was not enough discussion about Smile 1 just being like 80% a remake of The Ring. It's just The Ring. It's just The Ring, plus It Follows, guys. And it is well made, but it is just The Ring.
I don't recall Girl from the Well smiling at anyone in The Ring.
Oh, she smiled. And when she smiles, bad things happen. But also,
that's
Smile
true.
One.
She does in that video.
Smile 1 goes through like all the investigational steps of specifically Verbinski's The Ring, and also even like Needles, the 7 days thing of the curse. Like, it's, I liked it. I just found it like, oh man, this is not as original as I thought.
So Smile 1 is a movie that came out 2 years ago. It was originally going to go straight to Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
And they decided, hey, you know, it's a horror movie. It's well made. Let's give it a shot. The movie ended up making over $100 million domestically. Did so well that it warranted a sequel. I think the budget is significantly higher for the sequel. It's like in the mid $20 million for the sequel.
One scene of the trailer of Smile 2 looks like a bigger budget than all of Smile 1,
yeah. To be honest. And I am going to give away the premise of Smile 1, which is like discovered during the course of Smile 1. So like, if you don't want to know the premise of Smile 1 and therefore Smile 2, fast forward a little bit. But basically what happens is, and Jeff, I assume you're not going to watch these movies of your own volition. What happens in Smile 1 is they discover essentially that there is a parasitic entity that attaches to people's minds. Mm-hmm. And it
a curse, if you will, that attaches back and must be carried forward. And the person who has the curse must therefore pass it on.
Pass it on within 7 days.
Within 7 days. Huh. And a highly intelligent investigator has to go off and like figure out this mystery.
Right.
Enlisting the help of all her professional friends, of course. Yeah. Going off to a quiet old house where the final showdown happens.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's all true. That's all accurate.
But there's no VHS in it.
Yeah, there's no VHS in Dundra.
It's true.
So anyway, that's essentially what the movie's about. And what the thing can do is it can attach itself to your mind and it makes you see hallucinations. And it one thing it likes to make you see is people smiling, right? Creepily. And that's where the movie gets its name. And this creates for some fun scenarios because what the movie can then do is literally at any point, anything you're seeing could be a hallucination, right? Like, so you're seeing something and it's like the person is always wondering, is that a hallucination or is that a real...
It's a gotcha engine. It's a gotcha engine for horror jump scares. Yeah.
Is that a horrifying thing that's actually happening in real life? So Smile 2 takes place after the events of Smile 1 and it asks the question, what if Smile 1 happened to Lady Gaga, basically? Like, what if it was Lady Gaga? It's kind of a combination of like Lady Gaga, Britney Spears, Miley Cyrus, and Billie Eilish.
Mm-hmm.
And what if there was like a mega pop star who had a horrifying brush with drugs and was in a terrible accident about a year ago and is on a rehabilitation tour, but then suddenly gets the smile curse for reasons I'm not going to get into.
That's what I was thinking of when I finished Smile 1, yeah.
Yeah.
What if Lady Raven got the smile curse, yeah.
Right. I mean, this is the second horror film that's come out this year in which there is a fake pop star with an EP that you can listen to on Apple Music and Spotify, by the way. Anyway, so that's the whole movie. And I will say I quite enjoyed Smile 2. It is very cruel to its protagonist. It's kind of like you're seeing a person psychologically deteriorate in front of your eyes. Like they already were like on the knife's edge before they got the smile curse.
Yeah.
And then like they get the smile curse and it completely like wrecks them psychologically and mentally.
That's also the first movie too. Like there is a weird cruelty about these movies. And also what it is, you are watching people commit suicide. And that is also deeply disturbing on like a fundamental level. It brings to mind like the scenes, some of the best scenes from like The Happening, which I think remember that movie, like just scenes of people like the chain of people offing themselves in terrible ways. And now they made a whole franchise about it. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, because the idea is that to pass the curse on, I think like the parasite forces you to kill yourself in front of someone else, I think is how that works.
Sure.
And so like one of the creepy things that happens in the first and second movie is like somebody is smiling and then they kill themselves. And it's a very like upsetting thing to watch. What really makes Smile 2 awesome is, first of all, there's like some great scenarios that the movie comes up with of like people smiling at you and that being like a creepy situation, right? Like what situations would it be upsetting to you if someone was creepily smiling at you?
All of them.
Most.
All of the situations. In fact, remember the run up to Smile 1, guys, where there was like viral placements of just smile people behind the like, was it the catcher at a baseball game too? Like,
didn't they do that again?
That happened for Smile 2.
Yeah, they did it again. But now it doesn't have the impact. The first time you're like, what the hell is happening at this baseball game?
I think that's a rough gig.
It is rough.
If you're hired to be the person that has to smile for a 6-hour baseball game, you know,
yeah,
that's tough.
There was this video that went like the ball went over, so the idea for those who don't know is there's a viral marketing stunt where the studio hires these people, these I guess what are they called, models or whatever, to stand behind the home plate of a baseball game.
They're seated. They have seats.
Yeah, they're seated. Okay, they're sitting right behind it.
I thought I saw them standing. Whatever. They're
they purchased seats. They purchased really good seats for them at the baseball game, like right behind. So they're on camera.
Right. They're on camera. They wear these like bright shirts to draw attention to themselves.
Yeah.
And brilliant, brilliant move.
They smile. Yeah. And the way the smile works in the movie is like your kind of chin is tilted down and you're looking straight ahead. And it looks
it's
very
a menacing
intense,
smile.
It's the psycho smile from the end of Psycho a little bit too. Mm-hmm,
Anyway, I saw a clip of that guy. And then one of like the ball went over the fence behind the plate, and the guy started like freaking out and trying to make sure he didn't get hit in the head by a baseball.
Oh, come on, you gotta
keep character, which
you gotta keep it going.
Jeff, it's a hard job, like it's a hard job when there's freaking projectiles maybe gonna hit.
I mean, that's the end of his career.
One job is to stand there and smile no matter what happens,
you know.
I hope not.
One job.
I hope it's not the end. It's very understandable to not want your head to get knocked in the head by a high velocity baseball, anyway.
And one job.
Anyway, okay, but the thing that really makes Smile 2 incredible is Naomi Scott, who plays the pop star in the movie. I think her name is Sky Riley. It's like this universe's version of Lady Gaga. First of all, if I am correct about this, Jermaine Lucier sadly won the Summer Movie Wager this year, and the movie that he asked us to watch is a film called Lemonade Mouth. I believe Naomi Scott is in that movie, so that's like one of her first big breaks, and she went all the way to now becoming Sky Riley in Smile 2. But anyway, the point I was making is,
I mean, she was in Aladdin.
She was in Aladdin as well. Yeah. But the point I was making is Naomi Scott is incredible in this movie. She's in virtually every single shot of the film. And you get to see this person like deteriorate in front of your eyes and like become crazed and a little bit mad. And she is utterly convincing doing so. And it's just like I thought about going to see the movie again just to see that performance because it is so convincing and so well done. So like that's how good the performance was. And yeah, the scenarios that the director Parker Finn comes up with are really fun. There is a brief, you see a little bit of Sky Riley's show in the movie. And in my opinion, it's incredible. Like, you know, Lady Raven in Trap, I enjoyed, but Sky Riley, I'm like, oh my God, like I'm actually bummed we didn't get to see more of the Sky Riley show.
You know, going
Smile
to the
2.
Taylor Swift show really changed you, Dave. Now you're just into all the pop.
Well, I was
shows.
Wondering why you were wearing that Sky Riley t-shirt today.
Yeah, along with the gimp mask, right? So I think, and so the thing is with the Lady Raven concert, they like make you listen to that whole concert.
Sure.
She's an actual musician. Yes.
She's an actual musician.
Well, the difference here is that one of them is the daughter of the director.
Yes. Yeah. And in Smile 2, you get to hear about like maybe 2 to 3 songs total, if that. And you see it, and it just looks so good. Like, you see it, like, on the stage, and you see it's in the trailer, too. It's like, it looks so good. I'm like, wow, I really could watch more of this. And then, unfortunately, you don't get to see that much of it. But anyway, Naomi Scott's incredible. The movie's a lot of fun. It's also extremely cruel, so you need to be ready for that. But if
kind of their bag. By the way, Parker Finn is just, like, killing it, right? The director and writer of this franchise, which was just going to be a streaming thing, is now just spearheading this major franchise, and it's cool to see. You know, I'm glad this just didn't get buried on Paramount Plus or whatever, because Smile 2 probably wouldn't have happened if it was just a streaming movie.
Absolutely. I mean, this movie made, I think, $23 million this weekend. The budget's around $25, $28 million, so it's gonna be in the black pretty soon, and this could be like an ongoing franchise, right? Like it's very possible we're gonna see
it's a
3.
Great concept. It really takes the concept of The Ring and it follows, like it just kind of smushes them together. And if you have good leads, I think the lead of the first movie, Sosie Bacon,
Kevin also Bacon's did a good daughter
and Kira Sedgwick's daughter, so she has that like look too. But if you have a good lead who can really fall apart on camera, that's really it. My question for you, Dave, is there ever a scene where the entire crowd of the audience does the creepy smile?
I
would love to see that.
I don't think I can say anything about that.
Okay.
So, but suffice to say,
if you put the smile demon in a concert, give me those weird ass grins. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You do get to meet one of the cool things about the movie is it does have some commentary on like what it's like to be a pop star.
Mm-hmm.
And often, like, if you're a pop star, like, fans will approach you and they look like they have that creepy smile and you don't know if they're the entity or not.
Yeah.
And the movie really plays with that, you know? The movie really plays with God. That. So, anyway, had a great time with Smile 2. If you like Smile 1, you should check it out. And if you haven't seen Smile 1, you should watch that. I think it's on Paramount Plus, probably, right? So check that out. And it's out in theaters, and I'm really excited that this movie is going to probably spawn more sequels, because they're doing a good job of managing the franchise so far. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be right back with more of what we've been watching right after this.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by Uncommon Goods. Spark something uncommon this holiday season with incredible hand-picked gifts from Uncommon Goods. They make your holiday shopping stress-free by scouring the globe for original, handmade, and absolutely remarkable things for everyone on your list. These gifts spark joy, wonder, delight, and that it's exactly what I wanted feeling. Whether you're shopping for your secret Santa or your entire family, Uncommon Goods knows exactly what they want. Let me tell you about something my wife got me on Uncommon Goods that brings me a lot of joy. It's called the Lovebox Spinning Heart Messenger. This is a little internet-connected device. It's a kind of attractive wooden box with a 8-bit-looking heart logo on the front. And it connects. My wife is able to send little messages to it during the day. And when I get a message, the heart spins around, letting me know that I have a new message. I open the top of the box, and inside is her message to me. It's delightful. My kids love it. They like sending me messages as well. It sits right next to me on my desk as I'm working. It's unobtrusive, but it's delightful. When I see the little spinning symbol, I can get a little, hey, I love you, or I'm thinking of you, or even, there's snacks in the kitchen. Come grab some. Whatever it is, it just makes my life a little more special. And there's tons of stuff like that on Uncommon Goods. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches, so you want to shop now before they sell out this holiday season. And Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. They have the most meaningful, out-of-the-ordinary gifts anywhere. And they even have gifts you can personalize. From holiday hosts to hostess gifts to the coolest finds for kids to hits for everyone from book lovers to diehard sports fans, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. Not the same old selections you can find just anywhere. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to the nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/filmcast. That's uncommongoods.com/filmcast for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer, Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
All right. Devendra Hardwar, you and Jeff Canetta watched something pretty interesting this week, right? What is that?
Watch something immersive on the Apple TV Pro.
Because submersive.
The Apple Vision Pro.
Apple Vision Pro, yeah. Something submersive. We saw Submerged, which is it's a short film by Edward Berger, basically having you experience, you're following a submarine crew. You're following them as like they experience a potential, I don't know, dangerous thing.
World War II era. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. World War II era. It's really, really fascinating to see people, explore more of this immersive filmmaking technology. I've been doing this stuff forever, like since the first 360-degree cameras and videos were happening, since the early VR days. That stuff never looked good. I was never a fan. It was really hard to pay attention to like where things are and what you should be looking at. Apple's whole thing with immersive video is that it's 180 degrees. So it's just like you're looking at a single wall. You're not turning around, but there is a definite sense of immersion. Highly detailed, like they shoot above 8K, I believe, and like cut it down, so it just looks pristine and crisp. There's a bit of dimensionality to it as well. This is a really cool short. It really shows off like ways that people could use Apple's immersive filmmaking mode. I don't think it's like a game changer, but certainly I would love to see more things experiment like this. I don't know if I'd want to sit through a 2-hour movie doing this thing. I think 20 to 30 minutes is like the tops. But what did you think of it, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, it's 17 minutes, I believe, this short. So it very much is a short. And it does feel to me like a section of a longer movie. Like it's not really a complete thought. You kind of get a little character, like there's one conversation where that you're supposed to care about. The guy pulls out a picture of his family. So I guess that we were supposed to care about him. Mm-hmm. And then it's just kind of like one little moment. So there's not, it does feel like, you know, a proof of concept more than to me than a full experience. Mm-hmm. But I also came away very impressed. You know, a lot of people have been asking, like, oh, you got that Vision, Apple Vision Pro, you spent an ungodly amount of money on it. have you been using it? Well, obviously, it has been a mixed bag, and certainly a lot of that has been disappointment from a usability standpoint, or not usability, but just things to do with it standpoint.
Yeah.
You know, Apple has really, I think, doubled down on this is a content content viewing device, and I think that's a bummer because I wish they had, you know, I wish there were more interesting, you know, games and Apple, you know, they want it to be extended computing, spatial computing, and then watch stuff on it. The immersive content on Apple TV Plus, there's a handful of things. All of them, in my opinion, are awesome, and all of them, as Devendra pointed out, are this 180 degree experience. Like Devendra, I've been an early adopter in VR for years now, and there's been some really cool, you know, 360 stuff, but you always feel like you're missing something. At least I do.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of animated stuff in particular, like cartoons, you know, 3D cartoons that are doing things where they're trying to draw your eye and make you rotate around and stuff. But like, there's a reason that a stage is in front of you. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are some avant-garde theater things that are happening all around you. But for the most part, people don't want to be worried about the stuff that's happening behind them, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I think Apple is smart here in saying, yeah, no, 180 degrees is pretty rad.
Yes.
And I've watched a number of 3D movies in Apple Vision Pro and on Quest 3. And that is really cool too, but you see the edges of it. And having this be completely immersive, as they say, to fill your view, you are inside it. If you look all the way to the right, all the way to the left, you will see the edges eventually because it is only 180 degrees, but you tend not to. I tend to watch it like I'm watching a movie rather than I'm watching some sort of, you know, 3D all the way around me style. I'm sitting there mostly still, right? Mostly just watching what's in front of me. And sometimes something will catch my eye. I'll be like, oh, what's that cool little thing dripping in the corner? And I'll look at that.
But it's basically my favorite seat in the theater, by the way. This is why I talk about sitting in the very front row. Because
craning your neck up.
You're not craning your neck, but it is a good perspective, and you're not catching everything all at once. I think that's key. And I don't mind turning my head a little for something. But yeah, it's it does reestablish some rules of filmmaking, right? You can't do smash zooms. You can't do like fast camera movements because you will get sick. The
but
viewer
every time
will
the camera moves
up
in this is awesome, I thought. And the camera move like you so first of all, let me say the handful of immersive things on Apple Vision Pro, on Apple TV Plus right now on Apple Vision Pro are all awesome, but they are all documentary stuff.
Yeah,
like flying over Hawaii or
parkour,
you know, sitting,
parkour in Paris. Yeah.
Yeah. Or sitting courtside at the NBA All-Star game for 4 minutes, or the, you know, backstage of the last Super Bowl. And all of that is awesome, I think. And there's not enough of it. There's just very, very small amount of it. But the things that are there are incredible. For example, the NBA All-Star thing, like you really get a sense in a way that watching it on TV just can't of how big these human beings are.
Yeah.
These NBA players. You really get a sense, oh my God, these are massive human beings. And you know, if you go to a live NBA game, oftentimes that's the takeaway is like, wow, I didn't realize how really just enormous these humans are. But
you still have to be really up close to even get that sense, right? So it's like sitting courtside.
Yeah.
I'm never going to get
underneath
courtside
the basket, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's even better than courtside. It's like you're almost on the court with them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, all of that is documentary in its nature. And this to me was really the first time I had seen something that's purely narrative, it really a film. And a few things stuck out to me, one of which is doing a close-up in this format is extraordinary. Like, because you see a human head larger than a human head is. And and obviously, if you're sitting in a movie theater, that's the case too. But this is completely different because it's fully three-dimensional. You feel like you're standing there. And when you see, like, you know, in a video, in a VR video game or anything, anytime you see a character presented in front of you, it's wild to have the sense of scale. And a lot of the great video games in VR play with that and shrink you down or make you enormous. And it's really very cool, I think. But to do it in a film where you see this, you know, photorealistic, because it's a real human, a human being, and their head, like there's a shot very early on in Submerged where you're behind the head of the main character, and their head is like, it is enormous in the frame. And it's quite striking. And as I said, another thing is, you know, anytime the camera moves, you're inside the submarine. So it's very constrained. It's, I think, a very smart proof of concept because the environment is all around you. And part of being in a submarine is that feeling of, you know, claustrophobia or being constrained or having, you know, things on all sides of you. And so anytime the camera like pulls back through the length of the hallway of, you know, the corridor of the submarine is really dramatic and amazing. Yeah. And then some cool stuff happens and you're in, you know, I'm tempted to spoil this because like a very small portion of our audience is even going to have an opportunity.
There's not much to spoil.
Yeah.
Like it's not much, a thing right. that happens.
Spoilers for Submerged, the new short film on Apple TV, Apple Vision Pro.
So some bad stuff happens, which is very dramatic and I think very, very cool, especially in 3D. And then at the end, they escape the submarine and you're outside of it. And it the transition between being in this claustrophobic environment to being outside sort of above the ocean is so powerful and dramatic. I'm curious, Devendra, if you had the same experience. I really feel like this is a format and a way of viewing narrative content that I would like to do much more of. I think there's a lot of potential here that this shows that I hope that Apple is investing in, because I'd love to see more of it.
I think they are investing a ton in it, but what we're seeing, the reason why the content has taken so long to come out is that it's really hard and it's really expensive because they've created like this crazy 8K camera rig and you have to have multiple cameras. You have to do dual, just working, editing, processing these files, bringing them in, like chopping it up seems really difficult. And also it is a fundamentally new way of making movies or a cinematic experience. So you have to relearn some rules. Edward Berger is the guy who did All Quiet on the Western Front and Conclave coming up soon. So I think like he has a good sense of like that. Like All Quiet was a really stable, like it wasn't like a super kinetic movie or anything. Right. So I think he understood like how to film this. But I don't think everything would work here. I can't imagine like a fast-paced action movie where you want more cuts. If you start cutting, you have a headache in an immersive video. So that just can't happen.
I totally agree that not everything works here. Another thing that struck me is the acting has to be different.
Oh, yeah.
Because, again, the scale you're working with is completely different. So, you know, you talk about a close-up being very a very subtle. This is like on a whole other scale. Mm-hmm. But also, it reminded me of watching, you know, The Hobbit in...
High frame rate.
Because it is so crisp. It is so immersive. It looks, achieving a filmic quality is extremely hard. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of really wonderful cinematic lighting and you know, a lot of cinematic techniques brought to bear here. But when you are looking at two actors sitting at a table in full 3D and you feel like you're sitting at a table with them, it is much closer to video or a stage play than it's like you're watching a stage play and you're sitting on the stage with the actors. Mm-hmm. It is that close. It is that immediate.
So does that mean you need to dial down the performance if you're an actor, you think?
It has to be so authentic.
Ultra-naturalistic, right, basically. Yeah, right?
Ultra-naturalistic. And there are several moments that I think don't really work in this short on that from that perspective, because it's hard, I think about the fact that your audience is not the camera. Your mm-hmm. audience is with you. It's mm-hmm. like they're right there. And so I think, I mean, I find this to be really extraordinary, really interesting, but it will feel false to some, because it's got that quality that I think many of us experienced with The Hobbit, where it's like, oh, that just feels fake. That just feels
not really
false.
Cinematic is the thing. Like, you get so real, you kind of move past the cinema, whatever,
right,
you know, wall there is on a film screen. It's fascinating, though. There's no place for an actor to hide, is the thing.
Right.
Like, everything that you're too. Doing is out there. But also, there's no place for the set or anything else to hide, too. Like, so there's these things will be hard to produce, because literally they had to be in a real submarine that looked very realistic, you know, that looked like a classic World War II thing. So
yeah.
even just that, even just
you don't think like visual effects could make up for that, though, potentially?
They could, yeah. but that seems really hard. Like, visual right. effects has gotten really good at, like, okay, this stuff is on a flat screen. We know we can track an actor's right. face or something.
Right.
But if you're like in an immersed space where you're like yeah. 3D and you're seeing yeah. a ton of stuff, that's hard. That's
you need to make like a 3D model of yeah. something that can like withstand scrutiny from different angles. Yep. And, you know, yeah.
And there's a lot of really cool stuff that's done here. There are a lot of really cool establishing shots that have this really dramatic foreground element. Like, you'll see a valve inside the submarine really close, and it's dripping water, and it just feels so real and amazing. And you've got this cool depth of field. So they are doing cinematic things here, but it's so different, mm-hmm. so different than watching, for example, Avatar, you know, in 3D, where James Cameron is controlling the frame. So, you know, on screen, you're seeing it in 3D, but you're seeing a movie that it has depth. This is not a movie that has depth. This is a movie where you are inside the set. You are mm-hmm. in the set with the actors. And it's a completely different kind of art, I think. And again, one I would love to see more of, because I think it has the potential to be really yeah, captivating yeah. and really powerful. But again, as Devendra so well pointed out, it's going to be hard, and we're going to have to
be hard. I hope James Cameron like has a chance to play with this, because this yeah. is what was in his dreams for so long with Avatar. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the movie is Submerged, and it's available on Apple Vision Pro for all 8 of you that have one of these headsets.
All
you can
of
experience
us.
It. I recently acquired a Meta Quest 3.
Nice.
And I actually got, I decided to go full bore. I got the actual glasses lenses to go with it.
Nice.
That was a big difference, because like before I had like previous Meta Quest, I'd have to get my contacts on. I basically never wear contacts, so I just basically never use the headset.
They fit glasses just fine. And actually, I know some people who prefer just putting their glasses in, because if you're sharing a headset, yeah. If
you
share
a headset,
Meta Quest 3 was a total game changer for me, because it allowed me to wear my glasses in the headset and have no problems. And that's the first headset that's like that. The PSVR 2 isn't like that. Meta Quest 2 and previous one like that.
Yeah. I have a large skull, guys.
We know.
I have a large skull. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that, okay?
But how hard would I have to press it on either side?
So anyway, got the Meta Quest 3, and I am shocked by how bad the movies and TV ecosystem is on there.
Yeah.
It is, there is no like movie store where you can buy movies.
You could go through I think Big Screen VR does like a thing where you can buy it through.
Not
there.
All, but it's not like really easily accessible like it is on the Apple. And mm-hmm. also, not all the streaming apps are there. There's no Netflix. You can watch it on a browser, but there's no mm-hmm. Netflix on there. And thankfully, like Prime Video is there. Peacock just got added. But it feels like a huge missed opportunity. Like, I was hoping...
If you've got Peacock, what else do you need?
Absolutely. I just want to watch the remake of The Killer all day. but yeah, I mean, when you were talking about 3D movies, Jeff, watching like 3D movies mm-hmm. on the Apple Vision Pro, I'm like, oh, maybe I can do that on the Quest 3. You know, good luck, because there's no store where you can buy
Avatar 2. Not built in, but if you go through Big Screen VR, that's the way to do it on any other headset. Also, check out Maestro, Dave. I think you'd mm-hmm. like that. That's the new game where you pretend to be a conductor. It is fantastic.
VR. Well, that's the real bummer for me is that Apple Vision Pro has a great way to consume movies, but doesn't have the gaming content.
The gaming, right? Whereas... Mm-hmm. Meta Quest 3 is has awesome games.
all of them. You can do PC. You can play Xbox Game Pass on. It's like it's awesome.
Yeah, but
we're gonna get there. We're seeing a convergence. Like, it is funny to see Apple of all companies a little scared of like what Meta is doing, but also Meta has poured tens of billions of dollars into VR and has very little to actually show for it money wise. You know, this is all really nice peacocking everybody's doing. Basically, back to
peacock. Have peacock.
As it were.
What else do you need?
As it were.
All we need is a peacock.
Yeah. Let's take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the job. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. That's my favorite part. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to finding the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking at LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. And LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats and might not have the time or resources to hire. So LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/filmcast. That's linkedin.com/filmcast to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Folks, I want to tell you about a movie I saw on Shudder called Mads.
Is the Mads Mikkelsen documentary?
I wish. Okay. So this movie is a 90-minute horror thriller that I would describe as Victoria combined with insert horror film here. It is a 90-minute horror film.
I love Victoria so much.
It is a 90-minute horror film all told in one shot, or at least it's done to look like it's in one shot. And yet also, by the way, it feels like relatively low budget.
By the way, you just described One Cut of the Dead, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, sort of, yeah.
I guess. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, so that's what Mads is streaming on Shudder right now. I want to thank, I think it was either Scott or Mike, who are listeners and friends who recommended this movie. And I really liked this movie. I thought it was really well done. It's the ambition is off the charts in terms of what they're trying to achieve, because it's a lot easier to do. You know, I remember when Russian Ark came out. I saw that movie in one of the like five theaters it was playing in, because I'm obsessed with like these one long shot things, right? Like I love this stuff. And it's a lot easier to have a one long continuous shot where you're moving smoothly through the halls of a museum than if you're trying to tell an actual horror story. Sure. Like, there's just things that happen in horror movies that are difficult to do in one shot. People getting injured or killed, people transforming into different things. Like, it's hard to do that.
That was also shot on film too, so that was hard on another level.
That's true. Russian, I think, Ark. They had like this whole like for Russian Ark, they had this like portable like hard drive rig or something like that. It was this portable rig they needed to use. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Mads is just the story of it takes place over the course of one night, because most one shot movies are real time, and this one is no different. And something happens in this town that's really upsetting and frightening, and you follow some characters as they go through it. And I am like, on the plus side, super ambitious. I think it largely achieves what it's going for. There's just some really amazing sequences where I'm like, thinking back, I'm like, how did they even do that? Like, there's just two or three moments where I'm like, wow, that's incredible that they accomplished that on a seemingly low budget. All the actors do a wonderful job in what I imagine were some very challenging circumstances to shoot under. So I had a great time. I think you should check this out if you're into that kind of thing. I will say, on the downside, the characters in the movie kind of suck. Like, there's just not that much time to develop these characters. As characters, they're not terribly interesting. And you might not necessarily care about what happens to them, which is kind of not great for a horror film like this. But if you can overlook that, I think you will have a great time just on a technical level watching someone try to pull something like this off. So anyway, gotta recommend this film. It's called Mads. It's a horror film that is made to look like it is one long continuous shot, 90 minutes long, on Shudder. Check it out. Okay. Devendra Hardwar, hit us up with something else you've been watching.
Sure. I've been checking out the new show, High Potential, Potential, starring Caitlin Olsen from It's Always Sunny. Guys, what if there was a quirky investigator helping out cops and they notice things? The cops do not. What if?
Are they a mentalist?
I can't imagine.
What if they have a high IQ?
I don't think you want to bring that up.
A sort of mentalist.
I can't imagine that scenario, Devendra. That has never occurred to
me. Are they on some sort of blacklist?
The wrong show, actually. No. That's not what I'm thinking about.
Have they ever traveled to the country of Columbo?
Are they Adrian Monk? Are they what?
No.
Have you seen Columbo?
I know.
That's okay. Anyway, this is one of those shows.
I was trying to yes and Jeff there. It didn't go well.
This is one of those shows.
It rarely does.
It is a police procedural with a quirky person helping the police. And I think it's interesting because it's created by Drew Goddard, who is a director and writer I like a lot. Director of Cabin in the Woods, writer of Cabin in the Woods, Bad Times at the El Royale. Did a lot of stuff on The Good Place as well. I've liked all of his work in general. This is not a groundbreaking police procedural, but it is a lot of fun. It is like it serves you. You sit down for a meal. You want a police procedural. You know all the pieces, the cop that doesn't quite trust the new investigator, all that. This has all that. But I think Caitlin Olsen is a lot of fun. Judy Reyes is sort of, I believe, the chief or the captain of it, too. So I love to see her in a cool spot. Taron Killam plays her sort of estranged husband. The cast overall is good. The mysteries, I've only seen, I think two episodes so far. So they're fine. But I hear it gets better, judging from the reviews I saw. So it's a Drew Goddard joint. I think for that alone reason, it's worth checking out. And if you like the idea of police procedurals, you want a nice, comfy procedural, this one's not half bad. It's just not exactly groundbreaking.
The show is High Potential. Apparently, it got, across all platforms, 11.5 million viewers.
Is that good now? I can't tell.
It's real good. It's almost four times as many people as watched the Succession finale.
That's so, one excellent YouTube video.
Yeah.
After a week. Yeah.
Indeed. All right. Anyway, High Potential. Check it out. It sounds like a lot of fun. Jeff Cannata, something else you've been watching this week?
Well, I love my stand-up comedy, so we don't have to spend too much time on this, but I wanted to bring up a new stand-up special that I enjoyed. I'm a huge fan of Ali Wong. Her new stand-up special is called Single Lady, and it is fun. It is typically for her raunchy, but quite funny. One of the things I enjoy about Ali Wong is that she's very transparent, plucking comedy from her own life and experience. And this is the first special she's done post-divorce. Mm-hmm. And many of her previous specials were, talking about her dynamic as a married woman and having kids. And she famously did an entire special pregnant, very, very, very pregnant. And so it's been, if you're a fan of her, as I am, and you've watched her specials as I have, it's kind of this interesting metasocial relationship where you kind of have been following her personal life. And so this is
kind of like what people have with us on here on the podcast.
Well, I did like that you did that entire episode fully pregnant, Dad, Dave. That was very, very smart of you.
With a gimp mask on.
Wow.
So I found it very fun to sort of be along for the ride, mm-hmm, on her journey and back into divorced singlehood. And
is her during does the special include anything about Bill Hader? Because that is her new
beau. She dishes.
Good.
Doesn't say specific names, but it's very easy to figure out who she's talking about.
Star and creator of a very popular HBO
show.
She
talks about a famous director that she dated. And
on the set of Barry. I mean, the show that this guy was filming.
Yeah.
She is with an assassin in it.
Yeah. You don't have to be have high potential to figure out the clues to this one.
But you had a great time with this one. You had a great time.
I did. I laughed a lot, as I always do. I think she's brilliant and hilarious, and it's fun to see her sort of in this place in her life where she DAGF, you know, she is so upfront about, like, I'm successful at this point, and like, I have nothing to lose, and I don't care, and here we go. And that's really, I think, a fun thing, especially when you're making comedy, a fun place to be.
Indeed.
So I highly recommend Ali Wong. See,
I hope to achieve that someday, you know, hope to get to that point, but.
Well, keep wearing that mask.
Yeah, thanks, man. Ali Wong, Single Lady, it's on Netflix right now. I want to mention one last thing. So we got a very impassioned email at the Patreon recently about the Terrifier series. You see, the Terrifier series is one of the biggest horror stories in the last few years.
Hey, Dave, can I interrupt you real quick? I'm so sorry. I'm having a moment where I think I said the don't give a fuck abbreviation in the wrong order, and I just don't want to get any emails about it. I think I said DAGF.
Wow.
Which is, I'm sure it has its own.
What is DAGF?
I don't know, but I'm sure
they will think you were referring to Direction de l'Administration Générale de France.
indeed, I was.
Anyway, DAGF. So anyway,
go ahead and talk about Terrifier 1 because I didn't want to get all those emails. Anyway, go ahead.
All right. We got an impassioned email about Terrifier, the franchise, And it is a fact that Art the Clown is probably going to become a horror icon if he's not already. And there's very few horror icons. Like, he's probably going to be up there with, like, Freddy and Jason and Ghostface. You know, like, this guy is probably up there. And it all started with this movie called Terrifier 1, which was made in 2016. I watched this on Prime Video this week.
Which presupposes, what if a clown were scary? Right.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean,
nobody's ever had that idea before.
Yeah.
Try to imagine that. So I had this vision of watching Terrifier 1, like doing a Planet of the Apes like run through, and watching Terrifier 1 today, and then Terrifier 2 next week. Unfortunately, I don't know if that's gonna happen, because then by that schedule, by the time I get to Terrifier 3, it'll be after Halloween, and no one will care about what my opinion on Terrifier 3 is anymore.
I care.
I appreciate that, Devendra. Thank you. That's nice.
Hey, even before Halloween, I didn't care.
I know, Jeff. That's true. Anyway, so I watched Terrifier 1, the clown movie, and I thought this movie was only okay, not very good as a movie. However, as a special effects demo reel, it is very impressive. And I say that not in a condescending way. I think this is how a lot of these films get made. They make a thing that proves they can actually make something more
compelling.
This
is the El Mariachi for this franchise.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
To a lesser extent, like the John Wick Chapter 1, you know, like.
No.
John Wick 1 was already like very good, though, you know.
It was pretty well cooked coming out.
But apparently the next movies are like John Wick Chapter 2 and 3, in that they dramatically increase in scope and nature.
And everybody gets bulletproof vests and bulletproof suits. It's great.
Yeah. So Terrifier 1, pretty tedious movie, I thought. Basically, the plot is a clown terrorizes and kills all these people in and around a building on Halloween. That's basically...
The titular Terrifier.
That's basically what it is. That's the whole movie. And, you know, you meet some characters and they're kind of okay. And, you know, that's it. That's the whole movie. Now,
well, supposedly the second one's way better, right? That's the whole thing.
Yeah, correct. Now, what distinguishes this movie is the kills, right? The kills are incredibly graphic. They are. And look, I have seen some stuff. I mean, we watched The Shadow Strays this week, which is also very
graphic. Is all right. It's you know,
but
a bit of skull crushing here and there.
There is stuff in this movie that, there were rumors that like Terrifier 2 made people throw up, that people left the theater, and I haven't seen Terrifier 2, but having seen Terrifier 1, I'm like, I understand why that might have happened, right? Like, there's just stuff that is so upsetting in this movie, and in particular, there is one kill in this movie that's so gnarly, that's so...
How gnarly is it?
It's really horrible. Mm-hmm. It's really horrible. It's like, did you ever see Bone Tomahawk?
Oh yeah. Reviewed right. it.
Yes. So there is a kill in that movie. This is like even worse than that one. You know, if you
that movie builds up to surprise kill.
If you've seen Bone Tomahawk. And so it's like that. And it's like, I can't eat, like when I'm watching it, I'm like, there's a part of me that's like in awe of like, wow, they even attempted this. They even like somebody thought this up and they tried to achieve it and then they achieved it. And apparently the next movies are similar. Like in that there are like kills that are like even more horrifying than that. So there is like, if you're into that kind of thing, if you're into kind of like this really gross out people getting shot and killed and mutilated horror, and you want to like see how that's done well, then I understand why you'd be into Terrifier. But anyway, I'm only an acolyte right now in this franchise. I have yet to watch Terrifier 2 or 3. So like, I think I will at least try to watch Terrifier 2 by next week. And then, like, I think I'll hopefully understand more, like, what the appeal is of the franchise. After having seen Terrifier 1, I'm like, oh, that was okay as a movie. Really impressive to see, like, where these filmmakers take it next. And I think they have taken it to really new heights in the next two films. And so,
are you saying that a lot of these are practical effect?
Yes. Yeah. Seems to be almost no budget.
Don't think they had money for a computer.
Digital effects.
For that movie.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's a handful of like digital effects shots or you know, trickery. But for the most part, it seems like they actually did this for real, which is legitimately impressive just based on the quantity. Like, there's so many people get killed in this, and they're like different things are done to them. They're not all just like, you know, cut in the throat or something. Like every person gets like a unique horrifying death, and so it's like, yeah, they really went all out in the variety. But yeah, so I'll be curious to see where they take it. Anyway, that's Terrifier 1, and it is available right now on Prime Video, and Terrifier 3 is out in theaters right now. Terrifier 2 available on video demand, and I am looking forward to checking that one out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right, let's get to weekly plugs. Weekly plugs is part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. Do you enjoy my David Chen's reviews but hate the sound of my voice? Join the club, because I'm in that club too, and it sucks. But if you want to read my review of Smile 2 and talking about other things that have happened in the world this week, check out my free newsletter at decodingeverything.com. It's where I aggregate everything I've been doing. So yeah, become a subscriber, decodingeverything.com. It's free. It's great. We got reviews basically every single week, and I'm really enjoying making it. So decodingeverything.com. Devinder Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Sure. Check out the latest episode of the Engadget Podcast. We talk about the new Kindle ColorSoft and the bunch of stuff Amazon showed off. And also my final thoughts on the Meta Quest 3S. My review is up to it, Engadget. So check all that out.
Can you give me the Cliff's Notes on the Kindle ColorSoft? Do I need to get one of those?
I mean, it's pretty. I don't think I don't need color for book type stuff. And I think you're better off with a tablet for comics. You know, it just looks better.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was planning on getting one of those.
But they look cool. It looks cool. Yeah.
Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug?
Particularly excellent episode this week, I think, of my video game podcast, DLC. It's our 570th episode. Guest was Rich Lovejoy from the Gamers with Jobs conference call podcast. And every time he's on, I end up spending money because he comes with some really wonderful suggestions outside of the box, games you probably haven't heard of, but he just awesome stuff. And I also talk about my journey through the latest Steam Next Fest, where Steam does these periodic showcases where they have hundreds and hundreds of indie games with demos. And I pick out my handful of favorites. So lots of really cool indie games. If you're not a person that plays the big AAA stuff, boy, this is a great episode for you, because there's some really cool, artful, avant-garde indie games that are really interesting, pushing the envelope of what video games can do on small budgets. So check it out. You can find the DLC podcast every single week at dlcpod.com.
Of course, I want to throw a shout out to the Patreon at patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, exclusive bonus After Dark episodes. Thanks to everyone who's a patron who helps to keep this podcast going. We never want you to donate if it in any way causes you financial hardship. You can always support the podcast for free by leaving a review for us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It really makes a big difference. Share our videos on Instagram, instagram.com/thefilmcastpod, or on YouTube. We're also there at the Filmcast Pod on YouTube. Thanks to everyone who supports the show in any way. We really appreciate it. Let's get to our review of The Shadow Strays.
Operator 13, Anda ditugaskan menunggu sampai pemberitahuan selanjutnya. Komitmen dan dedikasimu selalu kami hargai.
Sebenarnya nama kakak siapa sih?
Welcome to the Filmcast review of The Shadow Strays by Timo Jayanto. I'm going to read the plot summary of this movie from the internet. Skilled in the art of killing, a young assassin defies her mentor to save a boy from a ruthless crime syndicate. End quote. Now, I want to read a post on Twitter, now X, from Timo, about this movie. He said, he posted this like a few days ago. He said, "For a lot of you, The Shadow Strays will be out today, for some tomorrow. Thank you for your willingness to spend 144 minutes of your life for the film. It's a film that's dear to my heart, a personal challenge for me to make a hardcore action tale utilizing a new breed of younger talents who have no background in action cinema. In this case, all cast I feel delivered in spades, including Aurora as Agent 13, who I proudly call my cinematic kid. She'll go far and beyond. It's also a love letter for the cinema of John Woo, Takashi Miike, Besson, to some extent, the scummy, desperate world of Abel Ferrara. Your viewing means a great deal for not only me, but for the prevailing proof that there's an audience for a movie such as this one. I hope to make more of these. Excited to see how far I can push it further. Close the curtains, crank up the volume, and happy watching." End quote. Devendra, he's invoking some really heavy hitters.
Yes.
With that one. Right?
I mean, John Woo, yeah. He's basically also invoked them with his other films, too, which I've really liked. Like, what was it? The Night Comes for Us, Headshot, which was a lot of fun. These were movies that, action movies on Netflix that did pretty well, I think, globally, too.
Yeah. So he's pulling from some of the biggest names ever, some of the greatest. Do you think The Shadow Strays lives up to those movies as inspirations for it?
I think it does live up to those inspirations, but also, not all of those masters always made great movies, is the thing. And I have a lot of fun with this movie. I had a lot of fun with this movie. My main criticism, though, is just two words: say less. I think there's a lot going on in this movie that is fantastic. Timo's talked about his love of the video game Tenchu, which seems like a major influence for like whatever the shadow, the actual shadow entity, organization, whatever that is. Like, they just look like ninjas that assassinate people on demand. But this movie is kind of that. And then we get a really great opening sequence, and then we don't get those ninjas for a while. You know, like, don't give me the shadow ninjas, and then wait another 90 minutes before I get more shadow ninjas, please. Like, give me more of that. I think this movie overall is like it reminds me of a lot of old school action movies, which were probably a little bloated, didn't have the best characters around, but they were a lot of fun. There was a lot of energy. There's something infectious about this movie that I think is just fun to watch, and which is what I really like about him as a filmmaker. You know, this guy is going to go on to do Nobody 2 soon, and he seems like he fits right within that wheelhouse of the sort of like John Wick universe and stuff from that studio. So I think he's super talented. I've always liked the way he's done action. I even liked The Big Four, which was a movie he did a couple of years ago, which was kind of a Jackie Chan action comedy almost. Like, you can really tell what his influences are. I think he's super talented. But this is like one thing where I'm like, oh man, I could see exactly how this movie could be tightened, how we could care a little more about these characters, and even how like the action itself could be polished, because it does commit in the very first action scene the sin of there's ten of guys just hanging out in the background. I'm like, we've seen this trope. I understand what it is from like earlier action movies and martial arts movies. Like, I get it. I can live with it. It's fine. Now it seems like, okay, you're aware of that being a potential knock against a major action scene. Block out those other characters, like something else. Like, oh, you're in a room with a handful of characters, close the door where there are like 100 other dudes waiting to attack you with guns or something. Just like, there are ways to logically make that cleaner, I guess. And you know, for ninjas, they're not really doing ninja-y stuff, are they? Right? They're just like, I'm just gonna pop up in the middle and slice you all open. I'm thinking of like one of the first scenes where we truly see Batman in action in Batman Begins, right? Where he's just popping out of shadows, smoking dudes. Something like that kind of would fit better. So I think Timo's super talented. I think there's a lot of fun to be had this movie, and I really enjoyed watching it. But I also see, with just a bit of tightening, a bit of cleaning up, like, this could be a Stone Cold classic.
Jeff Cannata, I'm so curious what you thought of The Shadow Strays.
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I thought of The Shadow Strays is best summed up in the form of a limerick. A sword to the cranial cavity can be fun, so why does it have to be? That this film's main attraction is tying its action to so much human depravity. I wanted to have more fun with this movie, but it's so relentlessly bleak.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And, you know, I think you read part of that quote, Dave, as we were introing this, something in the reference of scummy. Scummy.
Mm-hmm. Apple Ferrara movies, super scummy. Yeah.
This is a scummy movie, right? Yeah. It's scummy people, scummy movie. And it, you know, it is brutal, brutal. The action is, there's a ton of it, often very impressive. The fact that the actors weren't action stars, or
the main actor, Aurora Ribeiro,
she's incredible.
Yeah.
Yep. She's incredible. Yep. And it's her doing it most of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, she's really a standout. And I agree that she will have a pretty awesome career. I can't wait to see where she goes and what she does. And I assume there will be more of these movies. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are really positives to pluck out of it. I just had a hard time having fun just because of just how relentlessly dark and bleak and dour the movie is. It's just such a journey into depravity. And I also agree with Devendra that
I thought you were going to go for a McCavity rhyme at the end there, you know, but
McCavity
next time, lost, like from the movie Cats, you know. So anyway,
wow,
that was my first draft, Dave. I agree with Devendra that the movie, I mean, it really feels like two movies fighting for control. Mm-hmm. You can tell that based on the running time. it is two movies length of movie, but also, you know, basically what this movie is a very tried and true defend the innocent young person movie. Have the very skilled killer slash action person defend the innocent young person. And we've seen that many, many, many times, and it always works. It's great. You gotta defend the innocent, and you're going to take down all the bad guys who want to hurt the innocent. And then an hour into this movie, a whole other plot shows up.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you were doing great with the, like, take down the horrible underworld that wants to hurt the innocent kid.
Yeah.
You were doing great. Like, let's just stick with that because that works and we get it. And it's, but now you got to have this, like, whole convoluted other political thing happen. And I don't care. It is, as Devendra would say less. I would say it's a hat on a hat. It's a hat on a hat. We don't need it. You don't need to add that layer of complexity that far into this movie. I'm already with you. I'm already in. There's already enough drama and stakes, and the action's already flying hot and heavy. We're already seeing limbs fall off and necks explode with blood. We're in it. You don't need to add this whole very complicated and overly confusing, you know, backstory nonsense. It's like, it feels like a hat on a hat, and it makes the movie overlong and bloated. And that's a bummer, because I do think the action alone in this movie and the lead performance alone is worthwhile. It's just so dark, so bleak, so brutal. There's not really any fun to the action. It's like, it's just putting people through hell. And so I didn't have tons of fun with the movie. I admired the technical prowess that is on display of choreographing, executing, shooting these sequences. So I appreciated the movie on a certain level. It's really not my bag.
A few thoughts about the movie for me. I overall liked the movie. I think I remember when John Wick 1 came out, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. It was either John Wick 1 or John Wick 2. I think I was listening to the Q&A podcast with Jeff Goldsmith, and they were talking to the writers and creators of John Wick, and they were speculating on like what a sequel for. I don't remember. It could have been one or two. They were talking about like what the next movie would be. And he said, I could imagine a scenario where John Wick is like on the run from the High Table, and he's out in the middle of nowhere, and then like something comes up where it's like he needs to intervene and like help out and save this person from a challenging situation. You know, like that could be like a scenario for a movie where he's like on the run and you know, and I was like, oh, interesting. You know, like that sounds like a really cool movie. They never did that.
He's just always on the run.
They never did that for John Wick, because he's like, we got to get John Wick back running towards the High Table, is what they ended up doing. And this is basically what that movie would have been. It's like you have this assassin character who is like kind of living on her own, and then she encounters a scenario with this person who really could use her assistance. And I agree. Like, I really enjoyed that part of the movie. You know, like that part is really well done. And then, unfortunately, I do think this movie is just really, really ambitious, right? Like, it really just wants to, you know, what if the kid was related to someone really important? And also, what if this woman was in this part, like this international assassin organization, you know, like, and it tries to kind of shove all these elements and ideas into the movie, and they don't all quite fit, or some of them, at the very least, some of them are more successful than others. Quite a bit more successful. All that said, I do think we haven't really even talked enough in this podcast about how good the action is. Like a lot of
good.
The action
is pretty good.
Is really, really impressive. And I will say, I didn't, you know, like Devendra, I didn't love the first action scene. The movie opens with a big action scene, and I was like kind of worried when I watched it, because I was like, is this what the whole movie's gonna be? Because
and the movie's 2.5 hours long,
right? because there's this whole trope of like, they're fighting one by one, even though there's like 80 of them, and it's like, why are they fighting one by one?
Point your gun at the person attacking all your friends. How about that?
Also, I have to say, this is a personal preference. I'm not saying anything about how good it is. I just don't know if I like this kind of handheld style of action filmmaking. And it can lead to some really cool moments.
Yeah. When the camera like rotates.
Like when the camera
angle.
Like rotates, or like there was like one action scene where like somebody's in a chokehold, and then like the camera focuses in on their feet, and they like walk around in a circle to get out of the chokehold. And that's like,
there's
like really cool moments like that you get with this style. And so I'm not like saying this, you should never do this style or anything like that. But like, for me, I'm realizing the movie taught me that I like the kind of smoother, medium to wide angle shots where like the madness is what's happening on screen and not like where the camera is moving.
Yeah. This is more like The Villainous, which had an even crazier camera, if you guys remember that movie.
But But I would say, like, it got quote unquote better. Like, the other action scenes, like, later on in the film are not all like that, or they're like, they have much more smoother camera movements. I'm just, this is just a personal taste thing. This is not like whether it's good or bad. But I'm like, oh, yeah, I think, like, I like action scenes where the camera movement doesn't feel as raw and immediate, which is definitely something he's going for. But it's like, oh, it's very disorienting for me.
It's sort of like, I like somebody who can use the tools of, like, filmmaking, right? Like, if you there's a reason why you would have a handheld shot in a dramatic sequence if somebody's running away from something and things are crazy, so versus a steadier shot.
I just remember there's one action scene that I was watching it, and then it cut to an overhead shot.
Yeah,
and I kind of, like, breathed a sigh of relief because I'm like, oh, like, the camera's not moving for a second. Like, this is nice. So I wish there was some, like, a little more balance between, you know, maybe some are like with the camera is like very, very stationary, you know. But hey, again, he clearly has like a vision for what he wants to do. What is also cool about the action scenes is, hey, you know, there's a temptation to be like, once you've seen someone killed by blades and guns, you've seen them all. But it's like, they really try to find creative ways to mix, to spice it up a little bit, right? To, like, make it so that it's like, there's lots of different ways to kill someone, and lots of different ways in which their body can slowly be dismantled. And that's something that I really appreciate about, like, the John Wick movies, about this movie, is, like, it's repetitive in the sense of, like, there's just action, you know, you know where the action's going and who's fighting each other and so on. But with every action scene, he tries to show you something slightly different. And I do think that's worth praising and pretty cool. And it makes the movie engaging throughout. So, like, I largely enjoyed the movie from an action perspective, with some stylistic caveats aside. But yeah, I had the same issues with you from a plot perspective. Jeff, you were going to say something else?
Oh, I don't remember. Generally agree with you.
All right, any other thoughts, or shall we do a couple of spoilers real quick?
Let's go for spoilers.
Let's go for spoilers. Here we go. Spoilers for The Shadow Stray, starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth.
Inconceivable.
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right, let's talk about spoilers for The Shadow Strays. I gotta say, I just want to bring up, like, the one moment in the movie that really stuck out to me was at the very end when she's fighting against Troika, and she, like, thrusts his skull into the like pointy thing into the, on the side of the post, and then, like, rips his head out of the pointy thing.
Great stuff.
I've never seen that before. You know.
Brutal.
That was amazing.
Brutal. So a number of spoiler things stuck out for me. First off is they kill the kid.
Yeah.
Any other movie would not kill the kid.
No way. I've never seen a movie of this kind kill the kid. And I think part of that is it's audacious. And I kind of applaud the audacity of it. But I also think it's a indicator that this movie becomes a different movie halfway through. It's like, the reason you can kill the kid and keep this movie going is because we're in a different movie.
And
that's kind of a problem for me, because the end of this movie is so weird. Because not the very, very end, which is also weird, but I mean, like, the climax of this movie is like her having this mother-daughter moment with her mentor, and none of that is set up for most of the movie.
We needed more of them together.
It's a payoff to something that wasn't the movie for like 70% of the movie.
It's
weird.
It's forced. It's totally forced.
Totally forced.
Would have liked to see more of Hannah Mollison as Umbra, as her mentor, because there's a shot of her pulling out the katana, and she flexes her arms, and I'm like, this is cinema, guys. This is what I'm here for. Yes.
I will say, what was weird to me about that scene was they're having this mother-daughter moment, but didn't Umbra just murder her mom?
Like, yes.
Umbra murdered her mom.
The whole thing is super weird, but it's also like, make that movie if you want.
Yep.
Like, have that be the movie from the beginning. Because It's not. It is so not that movie for so much of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It really struck me as discordant, because it's like, oh, I'm supposed to give a shit about this relationship that you haven't. The movie itself hasn't given a shit about for so long.
It feels like it's pulling from a few things, like the original killer, you know, where like, the killer has like a doubt about what they did and who they hurt because of their job. So that's the beginning of this movie, but also reminds me of like the Bourne supremacy at the end, where it's like, Bourne has regrets for how he hurt this person, and they're trying to shove that in here too.
No, I get it. I get the themes, but it just feels like they're manufactured at the end instead of.
I agree.
Yeah.
Also some like practical things. By the point where it's like Nomi and Umbra fighting, it's two women with dark hair wearing all black. It is really hard to tell who is fighting who at that point. Like, give somebody a flash of color, just something to help me understand the choreography of what I'm watching. I think this movie falls victim to that a couple of times too. Like, it's hard to, because it's so shaky, because everything moves so quickly, it's hard to like track who you're supposed to be tracking. And I think way back, like, that's something martial arts movies have done a good job of, like, trying to make you see.
Well, I think that's partly due to the fact that most of this movie takes place at night.
Yes, that too. They're all dressed in black.
There's like very few daytime action scenes, so it's like that would have also helped to identify people. But all these like little decisions that go into like how to make these scenes that like may or may not have an impact on how you perceive them. But I agree, Jeff. It kind of just becomes a different movie. It's like two movies in one, basically. Yeah. It's like these two movies, and they kind of fight against each other. And he's trying something, right? Like, he's trying. Yeah. This is, and I think it's clearly, based on the ending, supposed to be the beginning of a franchise, right?
And a good reveal of that end, because we're sitting down watching an Indonesian action movie, and who do we want to see? Want to see that guy from the raid. Want to see
that guy does show up, and it's pretty cool when that guy shows up, but also because that guy's there and there's that guy. But I didn't like the girl that shows up. It's like
Yayan Ruhian.
The girl that shows up, and she's just, we're all just gonna let her walk away and be the villain in the next movie.
That's a very that girl is also very much an anime villain type of person. Yeah. Like, she would appear in like more of like a Japanese action movie. So there's possibilities here, you know. That's what we're building up to.
It felt like I had the feeling of like what much of the audience probably feels at a post-credit Marvel movie when they're like, well, who the fuck is this guy? You know? And some people in the audience are like, whoa! And other people are just like, that's just a new character now?
How badass if this person came up in Master Burai just like, you know, that took them down in one shot or something. Really, cement who Yayan is.
Do you guys have a favorite character from the movie? I got to say, I really liked Tasuke Namiya, who played Soraya in the movie. Mm-hmm. She's that woman who is working at the club.
Kind of crazy,
And then you find out she's like kind of...
She's the shotgun chick.
And like, she doesn't have that many lines in the movie. She like has some scenes early on, and then like
screaming,
says almost nothing for the rest of the movie.
Screams and shoots a shotgun. That's what she does.
Yeah, and I just thought she is a total badass. That's my feeling.
I think for me, it's
Umbra. Death is awesome too. Getting hit
her
by the car.
Her death is awesome. Her death is super awesome. For me, it's Umbra though, because to me, that is a really, again, the movie should be more about her and her relationship to Nomi 13.
I agree.
Because like that is the thing. I think Umbra comes in and basically offs everybody in the first action sequence too, and we see her as the sort of like mature, more powerful version of like the 13 character. There's just a lot there. There's so much there. Would love more of them interacting, more of their relationship, and also Umbra being more of a badass.
Another thing I want to point out that I think is cool that you don't see very often in movies is the nail grenade.
Yep.
That's pretty rad.
That's
how that thing plays out, and shutting the door, like throwing the nail grenade, shutting the door. So cool.
That's so cool. Yeah. Jeff, I would highly recommend, if you like this style of action, check out The Big Four, which is more of an action comedy type of deal, like a classic Jackie Chan movie.
I'm into that.
Really fun, less bleak, and really shows like what Timo's has range, basically.
It just feels like so much of this movie is just like, oh, the worst people doing the worst things to other people all the time. I just felt like it's like awful. The movie establishes it right in that first action sequence where the woman in the kimono just gets mercilessly gunned down for no reason at all. And it's like, mm-hmm. oh, that's the movie we're in now. It's like, this is going to be dark.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any other moments you want to highlight? You guys have a favorite fight scene or anything like that? I liked the club action stuff was pretty good. I thought was, you know, I enjoyed that. Yeah. I also think like Troika's introduction was pretty awesome. Just like having a character crush another character's skull, like right away. It's like, oh wow, this guy is superpowered basically.
Yeah.
And then, there were some moments about the like final action scenes that I thought were really well done. I can't stand the idea of like having a plastic mask on and like the plastic melting. Like that just is like really upsetting.
Pretty rough.
And that happened twice in the movie.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Once at the Jackie's apartment, and then the next time at the end with the gimp mask on. It's just like
it's a little rough.
Don't like that.
I don't quite understand Jackie as a character who is both like we want to be sympathetic towards him because he's not as bad as everybody else, but at certain points, like he straight up stops her from killing the big bad who goes on to kill other people. Like it's confusing. There's a lot of confusing things happening too here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little bit. I will say that him as a character does not feel fully drawn to me because, you know, on the, like he takes 13 to his boss and it's like, why would he do that? Doesn't he know that it would almost certainly result in his death, which it does? You know,
there's
like,
a lot of practical decisions taken. Why
but
by
maybe
the end?
But maybe he's not that smart. And so maybe that's why he did it. But then like, but
he
then
has a grandma or a mom.
Yeah. He's but then he's loyal to his boss, which is why he stops 13 from killing him. But then like at the end, he like tells 13 that Manji's dead. It's like, you know, I'm not sure why he's doing anything.
Why is he? You know, it's like at the end too, when like the shadow, the boss of 13 and Umbra and everybody is like, okay, Umbra, take care of this problem, and walks away. I'm like, dude, you're already not satisfied with her ability to like often, you know,
you have a gun in your hand.
You have a gun in your hand. Don't just walk away and like be annoyed. That's just bad management. When you know, just do the job yourself.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that. Yeah,
this movie's gunplay too is it takes the John Wick close-up shooting thing and it adds a. I'm not just going to shoot you a close-up. I'm going to empty my clip. When you are clearly already dead, I'm still shooting.
You've
been dead
thing.
For minutes, and I'm still just emptying my clip into you.
Excess stabbing, excess shooting, I feel like has been a trademark for him for a while. But you know what? At least they're not wearing bulletproof suits.
I'm just impressed by the sheer quality. Like, every time somebody gets stabbed or shot is like a visual effect or a special effect or something. And it happens thousands of times during the course of
it really
the,
does. You know,
and it's just like the sheer magnitude of the amount of work that is needed to like pull this off.
The blood budget alone.
Blood budget.
If there, you know, if it even was a blood budget, like I don't know how much of it was visual effects.
I'm sure.
Like,
I mean, just I'm seeing painting. One of the things I dug about this movie, and I like in action movies in general, is when the main character is also effed up. You know, like
right.
It's not easy to get through this, and she's just as messed up at the end as
everybody.
They
deteriorate. Their clothing becomes more and more soaked through with blood.
Yeah, by the end, she's just bathed in blood. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, once again, shout out to Aurora Ribeiro. 2 months of like intensive training to accomplish a lot of this. So
she's so good.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So good in this.
And so like, young. She started filming when they were like 18, I believe. So yeah.
It's not an easy thing to believe that someone can take down a room full of people.
Right.
You know? And I do. I was like, I'm in. I buy it. I buy that she's this badass.
Well, I mean, speaking of like bad management, Devendra, like what was the plan at the end? It's like, first of all, if I'm just going to put this out there. If I'm showing up to a drug deal.
Yeah.
And the person on the other end of the drug deal has a gun pointed at the person who's holding the drugs or the money.
Not a good sign.
I'm going to have some questions.
Yeah.
I'm going to be like, what's going on there? Like, why? Usually you don't have a person who you are threatening, you know, to do the job.
Seems a little dangerous.
The money.
Yeah.
That's weird. And then I guess the goal is, like, the deals are literally physically laid out in such a way that what happens in the movie can't happen. Like, they're literally, like, physically super far apart. Like, a representative goes up from each person, you know, to the middle barrel thing. And it's like, and she's like, okay, now run over and shoot him in the head. And it's like, how is this different than you just doing it? Like,
yeah, I know.
What's your plan here, buddy?
How is this? You know, because
it's like, it's so funny. We're like, we need your services of a ninja. It's well, like, how am I going to do it? Well, you're going to walk over there and you're going to shoot him. It's like, any idiot could do that.
When they said that, I was like, oh, this is going to be super. She's going to like go into their lair. And,
she's going to like jump down from the ceiling.
What only a ninja could do. It's like, no. Walk across over there.
No, we're doing a freaking we're doing a buy. And we're all spread out. It's like, so walk over there and shoot him in the. It's like, literally, everyone saw that you were with them.
Yeah.
Like, literally saw that the 13 was with them. You know, like, they're going to blame you if this woman walks over there and shoots him.
And there's no ninjaing involved.
Weird.
Yeah. It was a little weird.
Weird. There's so many scenarios in this movie where I'm like, that could have been, I don't know, maybe a little smarter, at least in terms of what the criminals were doing. Why was the politician there? He didn't need to be there.
That's another thing. Like, what's that?
Just hanging out.
He would never be there.
He would never have Manji duty.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. No way. Plausible deniability, baby.
Yeah. Neither of them would probably be there. But anyway.
Another cool action-y thing that I thought was clever I'd never seen before is the bad guy kicking through the window of the car, leaving shattered glass. She taking his foot and sliding it across the shards of glass.
Yeah.
Clever idea. Very clever idea.
There's a couple of moments like that where it's like, oh, like somebody kicks a foot through a glass and you're like, oh, I hope no one actually, you know, touches that. And then boom, they slam the leg down on it. It's like, the thing that I fear the most.
Everything is the most brutal way this could happen.
Yeah. I was thinking about it though. It's like, why tie Manji in with the politics of it all? And I guess they wanted to give bigger stakes to the whole Manji thing, right? Like
hat on a hat.
It's because if it's just Manji, if it's just some kid, like what's
it be some gangsters?
You know.
We are already invested because it's a kid.
Right.
It's an innocent kid. It doesn't need, you don't need all that.
Yeah.
I think it's like, it's to basically be like, why would anyone give a shit? Like, there needs to be a reason why the crime family gives a shit about the kid. Like, if it's just some random kid, then no one cares. She can have a kid. No one cares. Like, but it needs to be, oh, this kid is critical to some.
I
component,
guess,
which
but
in
I,
this case is
I don't agree with that because we know that the weird dude has a fetish for like beating up people. So like he wants
to beat
up the kid.
It could have just been the kid saw his mom get murdered by the crime family, and
you won't get to take what's mine. The kid's mine. Screw you. I'm the evil bad guy. You don't get what I don't. None of it.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't work. Like, why is the kid even alive? Is the thing. If he was a threat. They would just kill him, you know, like that's the thing. So I feel like the logical next step for a lot of the characters and the plot points weren't fully figured through. So.
I think my guess is he wanted to give it this grand operatic scope of like, this goes all the way to the highest levels of government. And also there's a shadowy assassin organization. And I think what our reaction is, you didn't need all that. Like it's this woman and the kid, and that's you don't need the international assassin organization, you don't need the kid, you know, but it's like also on the flip side, it's like that's how you enable these massive action scenes theoretically, right? Like who has the resources to have like 80 guys, you know, like
that's never stopped movies in the past,
right?
This movie is very much Monkey Man too. Like it's a quest for revenge, but you know, the politician at the top is corrupt, also tied to religion. Like there's, I don't know how this reflects like Indonesian society or anything, but I also know like there's a lot of political mess that they're dealing with too. Yeah.
All right, folks, any other thoughts on The Shadow Strays? I had a good time. Sounds like you had a good time.
Go watch his other movies. Like this dude does make bangers too. So Night Comes for Us, Kill Headshot, and also again his VHS 2 segment with Gareth Edwards or Evans, I always forget. The Raid guy.
Evans.
Evans, fantastic stuff.
Looking forward to that movie, by the way.
Yes.
His what is it called? Havoc. Mm-hmm. That movie apparently has finally finished shooting. So I'm really excited about that. I imagine it was probably a hellish production, because it's been years in the making. In any case, I think Timo is one of the most exciting action filmmakers working today, and his work is worth checking out. And at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Timo Cianto made a movie. You can find more episodes of The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McCune from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode, with video assistance from Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, we've talked about it. We've debated it.
We tried to avoid it.
We tried to avoid it, but it's going to be Venom the Last Dance.
We must have the last dance.
We've danced twice before.
I mean, Venom 1 was actually like some amount of fun. Venom 2 was awful. Yeah.
Venom 2 is terrible.
And the question is this character going to go out on a high note or not? You know, that's the question before us. So we'll find out right here next week on The Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for being a supporter of Patreon. Until next week, we'll see you later. Goodbye.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.